Thank you so much for listening to Urbanistica podcast. I am Mustafa Sharif, an urban planner, and you're more than welcome to join my big journey of exploring the making of smarter and more livable cities. Please don't forget to follow Urbanistica on the different social media platforms, and also let's connect on LinkedIn. Big thanks to Urbanistica podcast partner, AFRI. AFRI is an international engineering and design company providing sustainable solutions in the fields of energy, industry, and infrastructure. Are you ready for a new episode? Let's go for it.
I'm looking forward to this episode. It's one of my absolutely favorite topics, child-friendly cities. And it's a big honor for me to have a great independent researcher, Tim Gill. Welcome to Urbanistica podcast.
Thank you very much, Mustafa. I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm good. It's been a busy week. I've had two launch events that went really well. 500 people came. Lots of great stories and reaction to the book. So yeah, I'm feeling good.
Yeah, and I understand that it's a big moment now, especially you're launching the book. And so again, thank you for giving your valuable time to record this.
You're very welcome.
So Tim, you're our storyteller for this episode. How would you like to introduce yourself?
Okay, so I'm an independent researcher. I'm a writer. All of my work focuses on children and young people, and especially on their changing relationship with the built environment, with the wider world, with the neighborhoods that they live in. And I've been working in this field for over 20 years, firstly with an NGO called Play England, and more recently, you know, as a freelancer. And I'm also a dad. I'm a Londoner. I've been lucky enough to travel extensively, including several trips to Sweden, in fact. And that's a big part of my work, I think, is trying to get that global perspective.
Yeah. And you're very popular here in Scandinavia, and especially in Sweden. So I think the entire Sweden will listen to this episode.
Let's hope.
Yeah. So tell me more about where did you grow up? What did you study?
Sure. So, I mean, you know, I'm in my 50s. I had a very free range childhood, like many people my generation, and that was really important to me. So from a young age, wherever I lived, I'd spent some of my childhood actually in the Midwestern states, so in Ohio, but then moved back to England and grew up in, you know, the countryside near London. I had a lot of freedom and could ride around the countryside, stay out till it got dark, all of those. And they're very rich and resonant memories. And I don't think it's just nostalgia to remember them. But anyhow, I studied philosophy and psychology as my first degree at Oxford. And then after a few years, went back to do a philosophy master's degree, but actually got a job with what was then the Children's Play Council, so a small NGO. And I would be lying if I said to you that was my passion, that I thought I must work on children's play. It really wasn't like that at all. It was just an interesting job that fitted for me at the time. And, you know, that was over 25 years ago. And I'm basically still doing the same thing. I got hooked. And of course, becoming a father 23 years ago made the whole topic much more relevant and engaging.
Yeah, that's an amazing journey. What motivates you to do what you do?
Okay, so firstly, I have a lot of intrinsic motivation. So if something feels good and interesting, I do it. And if it starts to get boring or frustrating or unsatisfying, then I'll just stop and change and try and do something else. So, and that's actually partly why I left the job with the NGO, that the other stuff that comes with running an organization just didn't do it for me. I do feel really strongly that children need a taste of freedom in their lives, and that's the kind of beating heart of a lot of the work that I do, that we've underestimated the importance of giving children a sense of their own autonomy, of, you know, what it feels like to be an active, engaged human being. And so I guess and that links back to my own sense of my own childhood. So I think if what gets me out of bed in the mornings is that vision of helping to expand the horizons of childhood and really honor and respect children's appetite for experience.
That's amazing to hear that you give the stage to children to experience life and not only decide their story.
Right. I mean, you know, any parent will tell you, any teacher will tell you, there's a really difficult balancing act with children. You know, we are adults. We have responsibility for their safety, their well-being, their education, their health. But they are also on a journey to becoming independent people, right? And we don't help them on that journey if we always do everything for them. So that's why I talk about a taste of freedom. And it's something that you can see children hunger for. Even today's children who have, you know, comparatively much more controlled, supervised, restricted lives, their appetite for experience shines out. And this is not about giving children free rein. It's about, I sometimes talk about a rich diet of childhood experience, and that one key, you know, ingredient of that diet are these extended periods of time and space where, to all intents and purposes, children have the say over what they're doing. They have control, whether that's play or getting around. That seems to me to be vital and under-recognized, especially in the English-speaking world. I think in your part of the world, I think that is more valued. I think children's autonomy is more valued. But I know there are very similar issues in Sweden and the other Scandinavian countries, for sure.
Exactly. So before we start to talk about your great book, tell me now, where are you now and what are you working with?
Okay, so right now I'm in London, like almost everybody, you know, I'm working from home. But actually for me, this is no change. I've been working from home for 16 years.
Wow.
I'm happy with my home office. I'm not happy about being stuck at home.
Yeah.
But so I'm working on a project in London. So this is a scheme. It's part of the Olympic Park, so it's an exciting high-profile scheme in the Olympic Park in London. I'm also part of a team that's bidding for a really exciting civic space, a public space in the centre of Leeds, so a big city in the north of England. We'll know in a couple of months if our team is successful with that, but if we are, it could be amazing. And of course, I'm trying to spread the word about my book as well. I'm sure we're going to come on and talk about the book.
Of course. Well, good luck with the project. And so let's start about your book. Your new book, of course, Urban Playground. I want to know the background of it. Why did you decide to write a new book?
Okay. So ever since I've started working in this field 25 years ago, it's been really clear to me, when you think about children's play, that the built environment has a huge impact and influence on whether and how and where children can play. And I very quickly realized that urban planning in its broadest sense, so, you know, where we build houses, streets, green space is crucial. And I've retained that interest ever since then. And about 5 years ago, having read a bit more around the topic, I applied to get a travel grant from the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust, which is that's all the trust does. It funds British people to travel around the world. And I was lucky enough to get that grant. So that allowed me to visit 9 or 10 cities that I'd already heard about from you know, international travel and conferences, and to find out in more detail what these cities were doing. So cities like Rotterdam, Ghent, Oslo in Norway, Freiburg in Germany, and especially the master plan neighborhood of Vauban, which you probably know about, Vancouver in Canada. And I realized that there's some tremendous stories and insights about these cities and why did they decide to focus on children and the built environment. What did they do? What lessons did they have to share? And so for the grant, I had to write a report, but kind of coincidentally, at the same time, Alex White, who is the commissioning editor at the Royal Institute of British Architects, so that's REBA, very prestigious, just emailed me out of the blue while I was on the trip and said, I've been looking into this topic of child-friendly cities and you keep coming up, and would you like to write a book? So I said, okay. And 3.5 years later, here we are. It's been hard work, but I know there is nothing like being kind of clearing everything away and saying, I'm going to write this down. I'm going to do the best job I can to communicate my, you know, insights and lessons, and to use, you know, the image and the power of the word and the power of the photo and the illustration to persuade people of the importance of this topic. So that, you know, having gone through it 15 years ago, writing my first book, I knew I could do it. And so that's how that all came about.
Wow, what a great journey. And I'm wondering, is your book to a specific target group? Who are you targeting with your book? Because you're not an architect or an urban planner. Many people think, okay, this is more about like not really related to urban planning. So who are you targeting?
Yeah, I'm absolutely targeting the people whose decisions shape cities and shape the built form of cities. So, you know, I want mayors to read my book. You know, I want city councillors to read my book. Of course, I want planners, urban designers, highways, transport people to read my book. I want campaigners and advocates to read my book. But the key people that I want this book to change in, and the thing I want to see happen is that the mayors, the people who have power in municipalities and at the national level, think more about children when it comes to the way we build towns and cities.
Yes. And if the target group open your book, what will they see?
Okay.
Case studies, pictures, diagrams? Can you
yes,
just
they will
share
see,
with us?
Yeah, they will see, firstly, I think a beautifully designed book. I'm
yes.
really pleased with how it
looks. I give it 5-star, 5 of 5.
Oh,
very
fantastic.
Beautiful.
They will see about 200 pages of text. Every page almost has got, you know, illustrations or diagrams or case studies. So it's an engaging book. There are over 100 images, full color throughout. But I hope people will see, you know, it's not just bright colors and nice images for the sake of it. The images really tell a story, I think. And there's at least 7 or 8 commissioned diagrams and charts that I worked with a close colleague, Sam Williams, who's another expert in this field, did some brilliant illustrations for me. So I like to think that almost any page someone opens on the book, they'll start reading, think, wow, that's really, I didn't know about what Aldo van Eyck did in Amsterdam, or that's amazing what they did in the favelas in Recife, or that Oslo traffic agent project, which is an amazing scheme to help get information about how children get around cities by using a really playful, user-friendly mobile phone app. So that's, yeah, I want to hook people in, but then, you know, hit them hard with the argument, which says, let's focus on children's everyday freedoms. Let's focus on making neighborhoods so that children can get around more easily and there's more great things for them to do.
Tim, tell me, because I got a question from my friends in Asia. They told me, is it focused on Europe, the European cities? I know you went to Vancouver as well. So is it, what is the focus? Can I, as a reader in Australia, also read it and
yeah.
use it?
Absolutely. It has a global focus, you know, and so, you know, two of the cities in the book are Recife and Fortaleza in Brazil. It also looks at Tirana, capital of Albania. Yes, it's in Europe, but Albania is the poorest country in Europe. That's a city that has a lot of the same problems that low and middle income cities have. So, you know, I know it can sound a bit arrogant for me to say, I think this is relevant everywhere. I won't quite say that, but what I will say is, have a look. If you're reading it from, you know, India or from China or from Africa, have a look and see what it says. And I think you will find that it speaks to these universal concerns about, particularly about how cities can go wrong and how thinking about children and bringing in children's voices helps cities to go in a better direction. You know, and I have had some good feedback from people. So one of my biggest fans is a woman, an urbanist from Jakarta in Indonesia, and she is desperate to get the book translated so that she can share it in that country. So for me, that's a big thumbs up.
That's amazing. Amazing to know as well that it's for the targeting the global audience as well, not only focusing on Europe. So if we speak about child-friendly cities, who should be the first responsible to make it happen?
Okay, it won't happen if you don't get the city leaders to embrace it. So, and I think the first step, more often than not, the first step is to get people to think about, to get adults to think about their own childhood. Yeah. When I'm running workshops or giving talks, I often start by asking people to think about the places they used to play when they were children and to describe those places. And very often the stories, almost always the stories you hear are of people's, you know, having a lot of freedom to explore, going to the woods, to the creeks, to vacant lots, you know, to and really having adventures and having the space and time to find out about themselves, to figure out, you know, how to do stuff, to just be themselves without adults around them telling them what to do. So I think those memories are a powerful starting point for the conversation. They're not the end of the conversation. I'm not trying to say we have to turn the clock back, but I am saying let's remind ourselves of this vital ingredient of a good childhood and think about how we can design cities so that children have something like that freedom again, because it's in danger, it's under threat, but it's not disappeared. And there are plenty of cities, including, of course, many cities in Scandinavia, where you still see children out and about. You know, where it's not unusual to see 7-8-year-old children getting around the neighborhoods on their own, and where parents aren't made to feel bad, you know, if they let their children play out. So that's what I hold on to. And that's the beating heart of the book, is that vision. Enrique Peñalosa, you probably know, that the former mayor of Bogota, talks about children being an indicator species for cities. That, you know, in the same way that when you see salmon swimming in a river, that's a sign that that's a healthy habitat. If you see children of different ages, with and without their parents, active and visible in the streets and the parks and the public space of a neighborhood, that's a sign of the health of that habitat.
So to start with, is that the awareness, the remembering, the memories, to just start to talk about this topic. Yes. But what happened? What's the next step in order to make it happen?
Yeah. I mean, different cities have gone through different journeys, but I would say the thing that kept on coming back from the cities that I visited, and these are cities that have taken this idea seriously, the unifying factor was that there was one person in the municipality, an official, an officer in the municipality, who was given this brief or this topic and had run with it, had been effective. So they were able to work across departments, with the highways department, with the parks department, with the schools, with the planning department. They were able to mobilize resources, they didn't necessarily have their own budget. Sometimes, like Ghent is a city where there's four people working on child-friendly cities in Ghent. And this is a city with a population of 250,000. They don't have a budget, but what they do is they're respected and influence the other delivery departments. So time and again, the cities that were doing the best, you know, the most effective, the most sustained work had this person. Then you can do all sorts of the other stuff. You can do pilots. You can, develop partnerships with NGOs and with communities. You can have good evaluation. You can build up a longer term program. You can have smart data. But all of that, you really need a person at the hub. And I call it a hub and spoke model. And it's that officer Of course, even better if that officer is supported by a mayor or a politician. That's what makes things happen.
Yeah. And Tim, does it cost so much to work with this kind of topics? I mean, to create a child-friendly city?
Well, I mean, there again, there's different models. So in Rotterdam spent 30 million euros over 8 years, more or less. So that's a lot of, that's a big investment. One way or another, of course, you need to spend money. But some, it may not need new money. It may just mean spending the money that municipalities already have in a different way. And of course, you know, the obvious example, and you'll know this from urban policies, all of the money that municipalities are spending on highways and road transport, you direct, you know, 5% of that into walking and cycling and creating public space. And the overall budget is the same, but you have a massive impact on making things better for children and families. Yes, I think so. I mean, some actual hard cash always helps. But as I say, Ghent is a good example of a city that did not have a dedicated budget line. It just had officers who had built those relationships with the delivery departments.
Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking now, like me as an urban planner, and let's say architects, urban designer, traffic engineers, how much can we impact? What is the role that we play in this?
Right. I mean, in one sense, there's not a whole lot of like knowledge or technical, you know, information that's needed. If you get the vision, this vision that, okay, part of my job is to make it easier for children to get around and give them more things to do, right? That's not that difficult to do. And you can take a residential street and you can say, okay, how can I make it easier for kids to get around this residential street? I'll make the sidewalk wider. I'll make the crossings easier. I'll find some areas within the street where I can maybe reconfigure the parking and open up a little bit of space. So now there is some technical knowledge, of course, that goes below that. But this is not like, you know, building an underground sewage network where you really need that technical stuff. You need people who embrace the vision and who value the idea that this is important. But getting it into people's priority list, inevitably that means, you know, you need to look at people's training, you need to look at the qualifications, you need to look at the continuing professional development, you know, all of that does have to come. I think what I'm saying though is that it's not the most important thing. The most important thing is to have support for the vision and the goal, and then the more detailed stuff, it's already out there, actually. I mean, there's lots of, in a way, my book, there's not much in my book that's really new. A lot of it is pulling together material that's been around for 10, 20, 30 years, but hopefully in a more accessible and engaging form. And so, for instance, you know, the NACTO, you probably know NACTO, the National Association of City Transportation Officials, they produce a fantastic resource called Streets for Kids, which is free. And it's like 300 pages of fantastic material that any highways or transportation person could take and use. So the information's out there, but what's missing is that embracing the vision and building the momentum behind that vision.
So what are the challenges that cities are facing? As you mentioned, we have information, we have the skills, we know design, we know urban planning. So what are the challenges that we are facing?
I think, look, it's really hard, right? Making strategic change in the cities. I mean, it is a definitive wicked issue. There, you know, there's lots of different starting points. There are competing interests. What is your goal? Some people will say it's the economy. Some people say it's the environment. Some people say it's community. It's hard to find a way through that. So that, I think that's, and of course, you've got almost every city on earth, you've had car dominance baked into that city for 100 years. So for the last 100 years that we've been building cities, they've been built around the needs of the car driver, and everybody else has been secondary. And we know everybody who's in this field agrees that has to turn around. But it's hard to turn around. But here's the message. Here's the most important thing in my book, I think. It's that when you're trying to turn this around, when you're trying to figure out these wicked issues in cities, bringing in a children's lens really helps you because it gives you clarity. It gives you a lighthouse and a sense of direction because it helps you focus on the longer term, right? If we think about children, we're inevitably thinking about the future. We're not thinking 2-3 years, we're thinking 10 or 20 years. And I think we can't help but think collectively because we have a collective responsibility for children. So again, it helps to get beyond the sort of, you know, narrow and short-term vested interests. And it's understandable. You know, people say, well, what do you mean you want to take away my parking spot or you're going to make it harder for me to drive to work? Oh, I see. It's because my kids can walk to school more easily. Okay, I'm up for that.
Yeah, I understand. So like it's possible to do. It's not something impossible to transform a city.
No, it is possible. And Rotterdam is a good example of a city that has, you know, still has a lot of problems, but it has done amazing things through that investment program that I talked about. You know, you can visit neighborhoods and see how a child-friendly lens has transformed these neighborhoods. And there's one neighborhood in London that I write about in my book that, 10, 12 years ago had a big investment in public space. And still today, it's a delightful place to walk around. And it's in quite an unexpected part of the city. It used to be quite run down. Lots of social housing, not very much green space. But so you can find these examples. Vauban in Freiburg, it is my poster child. It's my lighthouse in the book. I describe it as the ultimate child-friendly neighborhood. And that's because, amongst other things, all of the public space in that district is given over to social life, to play, to green space, you know, to walkable, cyclable streets. And levels of car ownership are very low. And if you do own a car, you have to park it in one of some, you know, a car park around the edge of the neighborhood. So it really is a neighborhood where people and children come before traffic and cars. So yeah, you can find examples. And that's, in a way, part of my book is, it was about showing these examples. I mean, people have been saying this stuff for a long time, but what I wanted to do with the book was to show what can be done visually and you know, through stories as well.
And I saw also you compare the city to each other, right? You have like a diagram, like you say, okay, what Rotterdam people did, what did this city?
That's right. So, you know, firstly, there's no one recipe. Although, as I say, I do think it's important to have someone in the municipality who's driving this. But, you know, no one city got everything right. But there was a set of principles that I thought really should be part of any program. So, you know, a focus on equity and disadvantage, which some cities had, but other cities didn't have. Effective ways to engage children. That didn't always happen. Actually, the thing that very few cities have been doing very well is data and evaluation. And I know that's an interest of yours. You know, I mean, we have to be careful with data. We'll maybe come on to that. But we really need to know, is this stuff making a difference? You know, actually, if you do tame the traffic in a residential neighborhood, do more children play out? Do more children start walking and cycling to school? How does that compare? You know, how do different interventions compare? Yes, and how do different cities compare? But I also wanted to have enough cities so that almost any city on earth, almost any city, you know, they could find a city in my book and they could say, oh yeah, my city is a bit like that. It's a bit like that. I mean, I don't think I'm quite there yet. I'd have loved to have had a city in Africa. And, you know, and I know that I don't, you know, I have a lot to learn about what's happening in that amazing continent. I would like to have had a city from India. You know, the challenges are different in different parts of the world, but there's no single blueprint, but I think there's huge potential for cities and activists and professionals to learn from each other.
Yeah, I think this is the important thing with your book, that all cities on this planet can learn from each other. And as you mentioned, there is not a fixed recipe. And I know you talk a lot about this in your book, but if I ask you, Tim, what is your recipe, if you name some elements that we need to think about to create a child-friendly city?
Okay, so for a municipality, I think I come up with this hub and spoke model. So the hub I've talked about, that's a person or maybe a team. Then you've got to have a focus on public space and streets. One without the other is no good. So that's the first thing. So you need to have a neighborhood focus, right? Children don't actually live in cities. They live in neighborhoods. So you look and you almost split up your city and say, okay, this is one neighborhood. What can we do there? This is another. Antwerp was a perfect example of a city that did that really well. You need to have good engagement with children. If you don't have that, firstly, you just miss out because your schemes aren't as good as they could be. But you also, you miss out on that kind of moral, you know, the moral power of actually getting the adults in a room to hear what children are saying. It doesn't mean to say you ask children to do the designs or come up with the solutions, but you make sure that the adults understand what it's like to be a child in that city and in that neighborhood. And then you have good evaluation. And then I think that's four or five ingredients. You have those together. And of course, a bit of money, you know, is helpful, or resources, as say, could be officer resources. And then you've got yourself the building blocks for a terrific program.
Well, I think great elements to start with. And so again, thank you so much for sharing some of the content of your book and the story. So where can the listeners order this book now, and in which language is it available?
Sure. Okay, so it's only in English at the moment. I have had some interest in a Swedish translation, but that we'll see if that gets anywhere. You can order it. It was online from, is it Bocus? Bocus, your... They've sold out, but I guess they will get some more copies. You can order it from the Reba online bookstore, rebabooks.com. And in English pounds, it's £38. So I guess that's about €45. Yeah, you can work out how many kroner it is. What else can I say? I think I've already said it's 200. And 8 pages, 105 illustrations, full color throughout. And I won't say you'll get your money back if you're not satisfied, but I think people will be satisfied.
I think so too. So let's talk about the topic that I'm also interested in, which is this podcast also is all about, is smart city.
Yeah.
I would love to ask you, how do you define a smart city?
Okay. So, I mean, it's not my area of expertise, but my understanding is, you know, that it's about intelligent use of data to get the city working better. And that's a kind of value neutral way of putting it. And in that sense, who can be against it, right? Who can be against the idea that if you've got access to data that's useful, you should be using it. You shouldn't be ignoring it. What I would say is that there's a lot of hidden questions. So what data, who's deciding, and what do they do with it? And those are all actually political and moral questions. So for my field, is a smart city looking at children's mobility? Is it just measuring how the adults get around, or is it measuring how children get around as well? How is it doing that? Is it thinking about mothers or caregivers and how they get around, not just, you know, the single male commuter? So, you know, these are, I'm sure someone like you working in smart cities, you'll know these questions are in the air. But I guess I want to say I'm all for smart use of data, but I want to make sure it's the right data. In my book, I say, let's make sure we don't just value what we can measure, but we measure what we value.
Mm. Okay. So you believe that technology can help us to create a child-friendly city?
Absolutely. And Oslo was a really good example of that. So this was the traffic agent app, which is a time-limited project. I think it ran for about 5 years. Children could tell the municipality in real time the problems that they face getting to school. So, you know, a kid is walking to school and they get, and this junction is really dangerous. I want to tell the people in City Hall about this. Look how far it is for me to cross this. And they could take a picture and they could do a thumbs up or a thumbs down and send it to a team of officers. There were four officers in Oslo City Council who could then, you know, gather all that data. They could see where the problems were. Of course, they were being proactive as well. So they were targeting some schools. And then they could figure out what to do about it. And sometimes, if it's a small thing like a bush, sometimes the kid said, look, there's this tree that's stopping me from seeing around the corner. So the same day, the people could get on the telephone to the maintenance team. You need to cut that bush back. It's amazing. But with more strategic projects, they could say, look, we can see that there's a group of children here. They want to get to school over there. But the route they want to take has got this really difficult, dangerous crossing on it. So we'll build into our highways program ways to improve the pedestrian safety at that crossing. It's a beautiful example of how you can use, you know, engaging, user-friendly, child-friendly, smart, technological processes to make the city more child-friendly.
Tim, you know more than me that cities are getting more complicated in order to develop them. Before, maybe only planners, architects, mayors were deciding, but now it's like we are talking data, IT engineers, and so on. So how much is it important to work together and to know about each other fields? You know, like me as an urban planner, I need to understand what the IT engineer is doing with the data or how it is produced. So how much is this collaboration or the hub, as you maybe mentioned?
Yeah, I think that... I want to say, I can hear, so Gil Peñalosa, you'll know Gil Peñalosa. He's founded 880 Cities, used to be the head of parks in Bogota. I can hear him saying, the problems are not technical problems. The problems are political problems. If you have the political, for me, the moral vision, the ethical vision, then you can figure out the technical stuff. And of course, it's really important that people understand how the highways people are using data and the data they're collecting and how that can help. It's important that we understand each other's disciplines, absolutely. But what comes first is a shared and powerful progressive vision about what a humane, healthy, sustainable city or neighborhood looks and feels like. And for me, that's where child friendliness matters, because it pulls together these different abstract ideas. What is a sustainable neighborhood? Oh yeah, it's a neighborhood where my kid can walk and cycle to the park. I understand that. That's a picture I can relate to.
So you believe in that cities for kids are cities for people?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And thinking about cities through the eyes of children will make them better for everyone and will help us to focus on the big challenges that face cities, the challenges of the climate crisis, of, you know, environmental decay, pollution, alienation, you know, the collapse of community. What brings communities together? Kids. You know, it's one of the few places these days where you physically see communities coming together on a regular basis is outside the school gates. Children are actually, you know, children and families are losing touch with the wider community. And I think that's a worrying trend. And I think it is because we're all living more atomized and individualistic lives. And again, if we can bring people out into public space, we've just been through, we are still going through this terrible pandemic. And I think one thing that the pandemic reminds us about is two things: the importance of community, of the people who we actually share our neighborhood with, and of the value of public space and of local living. And so you could see that this really difficult experience, especially difficult for children, can be the springboard that gets all of us to say, oh yeah, actually these things that we hadn't really been paying much attention to, they really matter. It matters that I have local facilities, that I have local outdoor space, that I know my neighbours and that I feel that they can help out if I'm in trouble. That, I think, I'm optimistic that will come out of the pandemic.
Are you also optimistic when you hear word technology or smart city, or you get scared? You know, I had some guests on my podcast, they told me I just get scared when I hear smart city and technology. How do you feel?
No, I mean, I think you technology is always it's a tool, right? It's like a knife. You can use it to do wonderful carvings with, or you can use it to do terrible things with. And you know, I'm not naive that there are clearly. I mean, I'm worried about, for instance, the influence of social media and of the social media corporations. It seems to me, you know, I'm not neutral about that. I think more regulation is needed, but I also don't think it's even worth starting to say, oh, you know, let's just ban Facebook. Let's pretend that these things aren't happening. You have to engage with technology. The one thing we've learned as a species surely is that when an engaging and helpful technology comes along, you don't get rid of it. You have to learn to live with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting reflection and talking about the future. So now you're taking the time machine and go back to the past. You decide when.
Yeah.
And you're allowed to change one thing related to urban planning and design our city. Yeah. What will you change, Tim?
Here's what I would change. I'd have 100 years ago, I'd have laws that said pavements and sidewalks have to be 3 meters wide minimum. You know, crossings in streets have to be a maximum of 4 meters. You know, these cars that we're building, they have to be a maximum size of such and such, you know, maximum speed. It's insane that we've got people can buy a vehicle, right? A big block of metal that has a maximum speed of 200 kilometers an hour. What, how could we, I mean, I'm being a little bit flippant, but okay, here's a statistic for you. Okay, in Sweden right now, if you look at, I think children over the age of five, this is serious. You look at children over the age of five and child fatalities, right? 1 in 9 of the child fatalities in Sweden right now is caused by traffic, either child pedestrians or children in cars. And this is the country that has a great child safety record and a great road safety record. I mean, this is the extent to which we've got the balance wrong between the needs of the car drivers and the needs of children. And that has to change.
Yeah. Do you think we can change it like in the coming 20 years at least?
I'm more optimistic now than I was, you know, because of the growing awareness of the impact, the adverse impact of car dominance, and everywhere you look. But I'm also, again, I'm not naive. You know, there are a lot of people who all they want us to just get out of our petrol cars and just get into electric cars. Now, you and I know that will make almost no difference to anything that we've been talking about this morning. It might make the air a little cleaner, even that's up for debate, because a lot of the pollution that comes from vehicles isn't from the exhaust, it's from the tires and the brakes. So, but the conversations are happening, right? 10 years ago, you'd have to be a real, you know, like a specialist and, you know, a nerd, like an urban nerd to talk about cars and trying to get more cyclists. Now everybody's talking about it, but we still have a long way to go.
That's true. Well, Tim, again, I'm very happy and honored that to have you on the podcast. And again, thank you so much.
It was a pleasure, Mustafa. Thank you for having me.
So Tim, now I'm interested in two questions, actually. What was the best moment of you writing this book? And also, what was the most tough moment?
So the best moment, there are two fantastic moments. One was when I had the feedback from my commissioning editor for the first draft, okay? And he said it was the best first draft he had ever read in his job. And, you know, okay, he's been in his job 3 or 4 years, but still that's a decent number of books, right? And this is the Royal Institute of British Architecture. So that was, and it's a scary moment when you send a draft off because nobody's seen it really. So that was special. And then 2 weeks ago, a great friend of mine and somebody who I admire hugely, Helle Nebelong, who some of your listeners will maybe know. She's a Danish landscape architect. She's created some beautiful play spaces in Copenhagen and around. She put up a Facebook post because we're friends on Facebook. And she just said she thinks it's one of the most important books on urban planning since Jan Gehl's book, you know, Life Between Buildings. So I just, well, that really, that was big. Yeah, that was big for me. Okay, the worst. So I had a few health problems, which I'm not going to go into, but which did mean that there were some points when, you know, it was proving hard, and there were delays. And so, you know, again, at one point, my editor said, are you sure you're up for this? And I said, look, I am up for this. I'm going to give you a compelling manuscript. Just, you know, have faith in me. But yeah, that was a point where I had to dig deep.
And you made it. Congratulations, really.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So did you have time for hobbies during these 3 years that you start to write the book?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I am not a fan of, you know, the kind of workaholic. I've never been. I like family time. I love walking and cycling. I've actually been taking up running. I did my first half marathon by myself 2 weeks ago. And this is, you know, I never ran until about 5 years ago. So, I value my free time and spend a lot of it out of doors. And actually, the other thing which is on my mind right now, we've just had a new member of the family, which is a puppy, a rescue puppy, which, believe me, anybody who's had a dog in their life will know that is it's very much like having a child. So that's been a bit of a roller coaster, to be honest, but has taken my mind off of some of the, you know, with the book and the dog, it's like nothing else is really happening, even though I'm trying to keep tabs of some of the things that are going on outside.
That's amazing. What did you say in the beginning? Workaholic?
Workaholic, yeah. So, somebody who just works 24 hours a day. That's not been me. I've always tried to have some boundaries between my working life and my home life and my free time, because, well, it keeps me sane and happy.
Basically. Well, Tim, I'm happy. And I would love that we finish this great episode by you giving us, the listeners, 3 takeaway messages.
Well, okay. Think about their childhoods. Think about the kind of places they used to play, how they got around, and what that meant to them, and how it helped them on this journey to being a kind of confident, capable, independent person. I really think that's a very good starting point. Second, think about the situation of children today and what's stopping children from having those, something like those experiences. And thirdly, what can you do about it? Yeah, what steps can you take that would maybe help children now and in the future enjoy some more of the kind of freedoms that we all valued? And if getting my book will help listeners do that, then I'd be very pleased. But other information sources are available.
Thank you so much. What will be your next step? Is there going to be a new book, or what's the next for you?
I'm going to give myself a few months to see how this book pans out. And of course, I'm spreading the word, doing a few interviews and hoping to get, when we are allowed to travel, hoping to do some travel. I've got 2 ideas for future books that maybe they'll come along, maybe they won't. But one is really looking at the history of children and cities, and especially of sort of children and traffic planning, because I think there's an untold story there about, now, for instance, most people don't realize that playgrounds were invented because of the growth of traffic. Okay, kids used to play in the streets. That's where children played during the mass urbanization, the Industrial Revolution. Where did children play? They played in the streets. Then cars came along, and the grown-ups realized that this wasn't really working. So they started building playgrounds to be reservations for children. So that, because so many children were dying, right? Hundreds of children a year in cities. So there's a story to be told there that, and maybe I'm the person who can tell it. And there's also, I think, a book to be written about, an accessible book about children's play, about this astonishing, amazing, mysterious life force that children personify. And I still think that there's a gap in the market, if you want to say it, that for a book that helps adults get it around play. So those are my 2 ideas. Whether they'll come out or not, I don't know.
Yeah, hopefully, yes, they will. So again, thank you so much. And I would love to see you here in Stockholm telling us more stories about child-friendly cities. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you very much, Mustafa.
Well, thank you so much for listening to Urbanistica podcast. I hope you really enjoyed this episode. You learned something new and also got inspired by the guest. Don't forget to share the episode on your social media and recommend it to people you think they are really interested in this topic. Thank you so much again for giving your valuable time to Urbanistica podcast. I am Mustafa Sharif. Keep up the good work. Keep loving cities.